Great to be with you on this Thursday, May 28. As you heard, Karen here with you for Let's Talk, filling in for your regular host, Tiger Bales. Before we continue, let me firstly begin by acknowledging traditional owners of the land where Let's Talk is broadcast. I'd also like to pay my respects to our elders, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders and non-Indigenous elders. And welcome to you if you're listening to Let's Talk through the National Indigenous Radio Service. Well, today we're going to talk a bit about New South Wales, not because of last night's results of the footy, but more about the history of the Aboriginal land rights movement in that particular state. And we're going to be speaking to a Dr. Heidi Norman, who's a senior lecturer in the communications program in the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences at the University of Technology in Sydney. She's a core member of the Civil Society Research Group, a board member of the History Council of New South Wales and Dictionary of Sydney. And predominantly her research has focused on New South Wales Aboriginal history and politics, with a particular emphasis on the modernising effects of rural shared history and the challenges of Aboriginal adjustment to modernity. She teaches in the areas of applied research and Australian history and politics, and she's going to tell us who her mob are in just a moment. Welcome to Let's Talk.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me, Karen.
Heidi, if we can firstly find out a bit about your mob and where you're from.
Yeah, I was born here in Sydney, raised here in Sydney. My mum's family are Rutleys from northwestern New South Wales, so most of our family. My grandmother, my great-grandmother, etc., really lived around Barradine, Boggabri, Narrabri, Weewaw, all those little towns. They didn't really move, from across those generations, didn't move too far out of that sort of, 30-mile radius, I guess.
Were they in the missions or were they living on the fringes?
Well, our family, Emma Rutley is on the one of the Gummeroi apical descendants, my great-great-grandmother, and her husband and her children, that included my great-grandmother, they lived and worked in the Pilliga scrub on the timber mill. So my understanding is that they were, at least for a short time, had a degree of independence because there was some revenue, they had some earning capacity working in the scrub. Certainly things changed by the time my nan was born and the depression. She did end up in an institution in Armidale, actually.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fairly, I think, that for lots of listeners and certainly in New South Wales, that's a familiar story, that our fortunes and what happens in our families is really quite interconnected with economic change and, changing sort of government policy. If continuing that theme, when mum was born in Moree, actually, and they lived at a little town at Balata, and they ended up moving down to Sydney and living in the soldier settlement housing that was vacated by the military after the war, and that's how all of our generation came to my cousins and so forth. We all are now sort of Sydney born and raising our own families here as well.
And that's the Rutledge side. What about the Norman side?
Well, that's Dad's family. They they're Anglo-Irish working class, blue collar. They were originally from Annandale, and they sort of have an interesting story as well. They were quite accomplished sportsmen. Played rugby league, cricket. Over the 20th century. So yeah, they're an interesting family in their own right as well.
And they came together through your mother and father.
Yes. So they were mum and dad were both living in public housing in the post-war era out at Villawood in southwestern Sydney, and that's how they came to meet. They were living in the same just a few streets away, from what I understand.
Now, you wrote...
If Mum's listening, she'll be sure to ring me up and correct me.
What's Mum's name?
Elaine, yeah.
Hi, Elaine. Now, what do we want? A political history of Aboriginal land rights in New South Wales. We'll talk about that in a moment, but I was reading your introduction to the book, and you said in there that you heard a lot about land rights growing up. It was part of the discourse in the family home. Why is that?
Well, I think, there's a few. I mean, land rights, it was the predominant focused campaign of, in the second half of the 20th century. And certainly from the 70s, it was a very focused movement, and looking through the archives, I came across a great a picture from a protest rally, and can you imagine? It was a cardboard sheet, and on the cardboard was written, "Land rights equal house, health, water, a tarred road, good." So at that time, land rights, the claim for land rights was imbued with the possibility of achieving basically everything and anything. You know, a tarred road, sewerage, health. It was so, there was so much optimism for what the achievement of land rights would, would be like a kind of wave that would come across all of everybody's lives and uplift them. So it was inescapable to be caught up in this optimism. And along the way, there have been several other moments. I remember when I'd finished school and I had a job in town in a sort of entry level clerk. And at the time, the Greiner government, this is kind of jumping ahead in the land rights story, but suffice to say, the Greiner government they were hell bent on demolishing land rights. And of course, Tiger Bales, who you're replacing today, was a key figure at that time in defending land rights. And the Greiner government was hell bent, and there was a great rally out the front of the New South Wales Parliament, the first of many, I should say, in relation to those Greiner reforms. So I ducked out during my break, or I think I had to take some documents up to the bank for this job that I had, and I could just sort of stand on the other side of the road and just quickly have a look at it. And my sister at the time was working at the Land Council and was a key organiser of that rally and of that of the campaign to save land rights in the face of those Greiner government changes. And I guess I was only young at the time. I would have been sort of 17, 18. And it was, a bit of a yearning to put things into place to understand more fully what these moments in time were about.
This is what prompted you to do your thesis about this particular subject.
Yeah.
And I think Marcia Langton also had some influence in you writing, publishing the book.
She did, actually, yeah. Marcia, as you would have a sense, she's such a great intellectual, and, we may not agree with a kind of ideological take she has on things these days, but she's certainly a great intellectual. And she was one of the original researchers on the Land Rights Inquiry in New South Wales. And her writing back then in 1978 was beautiful. She was taking some time out from her studies at the ANU, where she was studying anthropology and came to be working on the task force. And she was also very involved in, from about 1975, in the movement for land rights that really, pushed and prodded the government to take a more organised and thoughtful approach to land rights. So she was there at that time, and then having conversations with her, it was probably, 8 or 9 years ago, really focused, a sort of theoretical framework to interrogate what this land rights laws were about.
Well, just for the benefit of those who haven't followed the land rights in New South Wales, can you describe the circumstances leading up to it? I mean, the interesting thing for me was that I actually thought that New South Wales had the oldest land rights act in the country, but they don't. Theirs is relatively new. I mean, we're only talking 1983.
Yeah, so it certainly came after the Northern Territory you know, land rights laws in 1976. The laws that were passed in 1983 were different again. So there was a degree of innovation about the New South Wales laws. In terms of your question, it must have been such an incredible time, the movement for the political movement for land rights. It of course came on the back of that earlier movement that, you know, we think about, say, with the Freedom Ride of 1965 and then the Tent Embassy of 1972. But this was a slightly different moment. It was a different time. So we're talking about from about 1975. And there were different actors as well. So there was a new generation that came in and were heavily involved in achieving land rights.
Yep.
And what I came to understand is that Kevin Cook was a key figure. And he organised a group. They came to be known as the Black Defence Group, and they were originally involved with the Aboriginal Medical Service, raising money, going around to various philanthropic or, you know, civil society type groups like Lions Pubs and Rotary and that sort of mob, raising money to fund Aboriginal medical services for at least a year with a view to ongoing funding beyond that. And they were, so you had young people, Kevin Cook was one of them, Marcia Langton, several others, who were involved in this sort of grassroots activism, fundraising. And elders from the South Coast, and this is what I think is really a fascinating dynamic in the land rights movement in New South Wales, that you had this sort of intergenerational influence, and elders said to those young activists that the issue is land rights. Focus your efforts on land rights, and they did. So Kevin Cook and Bob Blair were on the New South Wales Aboriginal Affairs Policy Committee. They pushed to have the ALP policy change to recognise land rights. They built up this incredible network of support across the church groups, trade unions, and of course amongst Aboriginal people. They formed a land council well before any statutory response on the part of government, and over, you know, hundreds or more cups of tea and these unhurried conversations, they really built a movement, and they built ideas for what the land rights model in New South Wales might look like. Keeping in mind that, you know, New South Wales and the East Coast experienced the full brunt of
colonisation.
Oh yeah, and colonisation has been longest. It was nearly always violent, and there's, you know, after more than 200 years of land dealings, how does a government recognise land rights? Keeping in mind their own political constraints, the fact that a large proportion of the state is freehold, and that, you know, that's an important difference to the Woodward Royal Commission into land rights in the territory, of course, because, you know, this is a vastly different landscape.
Yep. You interviewed what about 30 people during your thesis and for the book. Mm-hmm. Was one of them the late Neville Wran at all? Because I would have been curious to know what turned the tide politically. Like, I mean, they were a progressive government at the time, and what turned the argument for the mob who were pushing for land rights?
Yeah, that was a really fascinating part of the study. And I guess a small aside, if I can slip it in, is that this kind of research, it's so much fun. And I really encourage young scholars who want to get their teeth into doing field work where you do in-depth interviews and, you know, spend years in the Mitchell Library in the archives with your hanky and, you know, anti-dust tablets and so forth to get into it, because it's great fun. And an example of these kind of interviews was with Frank Walker. And while I didn't interview Neville Wran, Frank Walker was the inaugural Minister for Aboriginal Affairs. So this was in 1981. And, you were talking about 1983, the laws coming through. To think that there was only ever, you know, the there was an Aboriginal minister from 1981 and never before, and that was also coincided with the Ministry for Aboriginal Affairs, which was, you know, the equivalent of what is DAA, Department of Aboriginal Affairs today. And, of course, Pat O'Shane headed that up.
Yep.
And I spoke at length with Pat O'Shane. She is an incredible woman. She's a deep intellectual, and, you know, she has some really fascinating things to say about this period.
Yep. I was going to say, had you started your research before the passing of, I mean, we talked about the Freedom Rides earlier on, and, you know, had you had a chance to actually speak to the late Charlie Perkins as well?
No, but that's an interesting thing because, you know, with all respect to Charlie Perkins, he was a very controversial figure in land rights in New South Wales because he was more aligned with the centrist or, you know, conservatives. So those activists involved in achieving land rights in New South Wales really had different politics. And when the Land Rights Act came in, because the late Charlie Perkins was at the national level,
yep,
there was quite a bit of hostility between the power base of the land councils and any kind of funding that might flow from the Commonwealth.
Fair enough.
So it's really intriguing to sort of map out these political differences. But
to your original point. Yeah, sorry, I interrupted you.
No, I think because we're dealing with so many, it's a kind of like a series of biographies in thinking about this land rights movement and the land rights laws. So it kind of, you can easily become quite engrossed in the smaller biographies as they develop in this study. But one particular character I think is worth bringing out is Frank Walker, and he was the inaugural minister, and he's since passed away, and when I spoke to him, he knew he was dying. He had quite advanced cancer, and so he was very, you know, he was very generous in what he had to offer. He handed over an incredible archive of material, including all of the cabinet and confidence documents that were yet to be released, and that, of course, is illegal. But his response to me saying, "Go for it, use them. What are they going to do to me?" You know, he was dying, so he was, you know, saying, "Bring it on, do it, just get the stuff out, get the material out there." And I think what intrigued me about Frank Walker was that he was a really great politician, and I think a politician from a different era, where he was both a kind of wily pragmatist to conspiracy theories, and also like an idealist. And the laws he developed in New South Wales, they have endured for more than 30 years. And if we think about the kind of reset button that is characterises Aboriginal affairs in this country, the fact that the New South Wales, this law has prevailed is a testimony to, I think, Frank's kind of, you know, clever mind and he's concern about protecting the laws against hostile conservative forces. But more so with Frank Walker, his father was a communist, and Frank explained that they felt kind of exiled he couldn't get work. So they ended up in PNG. I think his father was an engineer and working on scrap metal from World War II, scrap metal, military metal. And so Frank found himself as a child living in this village community. And he said the kids, initially, they wouldn't have a thing to do with him because they said he stank. And he attributed that, his smell, to the kind of food, the Western diet. But once he came to be eating more of the local diet, he felt, and learning language, he became much more accepted by the children. And when they returned to New South Wales, they moved to Coffs Harbour, Frank took that sense of being marginal and an outsider, an outlier, to understand and have solidarity with the experiences of Aboriginal people on the North Coast. And that extended to the revocation of reserve lands at the time. And he got involved with a church group up there, and he explained to me one time he went to a sit-in at the picture theatre in Bowerville when this kind of segregation was in place, and he explained his experience of getting a good kicking from the cops. So that would have been familiar for a lot of black fellas up there, but for Frank, you know, he was someone who was willing to put himself in the shoes of other people. And you don't, you know, I think it revealed a kind of a deep empathy. And so he was a key figure in drafting the laws.
You're listening to Let's Talk here on 98.9 FM and the National Indigenous Radio Service. I'm with Heidi Norman, who's the author of What Do We Want? A Political History of Aboriginal Land Rights in New South Wales. Back with Heidi in just a moment. You're listening to Let's Talk, Karen Durante with you, and I'm with Dr. Heidi Norman, a senior lecturer in the Communications Program in the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences at the University of Technology, Sydney. She is also the author of What Do We Want? A Political History of Aboriginal Land Rights in New South Wales. And surprisingly, there's not too many books on this subject, I understand, Heidi.
Yeah, just this one at the moment.
You're going to spark a revival or a lot of them, I imagine, because, you know, there are a lot of players, as you were saying before, and interesting people that you've obviously encountered as part of your research. One of the things one of the chapters deals with is that once the, you know, Land Rights Act was realised, we were talking a bit about Frank Walker there, this, I guess, tension grew as those who proposed the Land Rights Act, you know, and land rights, found out that even though, you know, this was a progressive and something that promised a lot, it actually was, there were limitations, as I understand it.
Yeah.
And what were those limitations? I mean, what was it? What sort of limitations were behind the tensions, I guess, between the Aboriginal leadership and the government of the day?
I think it's a big story, and so I'm trying to. It's a little bit truncated what I'm saying now, but at the least in. There was a land rights inquiry from 1978, and that inquiry, the recommendations that came out of that, I think there were about 26, they were so wide sweeping, and they included the recovery of all land, including freehold, a tribunal for assessing and recovering that would be Aboriginal run and managed, sites and heritage, sites of significance. What else? A compensation fund, the land recovery mechanism, and the regional, state, regional, and local network. But can you imagine that report? It really raised expectations and hopes, and it followed those members of parliament. Also, it was a different inquiry. It was a game changer. Those members of parliament, they went out into the community. They sat around, and I've got some terrific photos that are reproduced in the book. One of those photos, you can see the members of parliament. So here are these sort of, you know, stiff white men in suits sitting perched up on car seats around a campfire, a drum fire. And they're at a cotton chipping camp in Wee War, and where there's no water, there's no electricity, there's no sewerage. And this is what happened as they went around the state. So they were deeply moved, deeply confronted. So not only was there this incredible movement for change, but those members of parliament went out and saw things for themselves and came back really boiled up to do something about it. And so the recommendations that came out of that report reflected that, that political will and just the sheer sort of will of those individuals to make change. But the translation into laws was a different story. And this is where Frank Walker was guided by more a sense of pragmatism. And what he explained was that it was about also what they were capable of getting through the parliament.
Yep.
And he says the laws weren't perfect, but it was a deal. And art is... both him and Maurie Keane, who chaired the committee, what they've explained is that politics is the art of the possible. And so into their mind, and they considered the passing of land rights as their a life achievement, and certainly at their, I went to both of their funerals, and land rights, what they did in relation to land rights was a significant point that was canvassed in their various, you know, the people who spoke at their funeral. And so that's how they saw things. But for the community, I think, expectations were raised so high that it felt like a terrible betrayal to have the land recovery mechanism limited to just available Crown land, for there to be no response or no recognition of protecting sacred sites. And in part, looking through those cabinet and confidence documents, hostile group to the land rights draft bill that was put to cabinet was national parks and the green lobby, and that was because they also had an interest in Crown land, because they wanted Crown land to be set aside for wilderness areas. You know, this was a different area, where a different era, when the push at the time was for land to be locked up as national parks and wilderness, so to allow country to return to a wild state. You know, that those ideas aren't in circulation anymore. They've certainly been altered, because we think about landscapes as living landscapes where humans and, you know, we are part of the nature. You know, we also manage the land. But that was the thinking at the time, and they were the most hostile. There were certainly concessions to the mining lobby, but the miners weren't as ferocious as national parks. So they were the strongest group. And for Frank Walker, what he was worried about, he's from the left, he was worried that the alliance amongst the left, so you can imagine church groups, progressives, trade unions, environmental activists, he was worried that alliance would fracture if he pushed more around the a mechanism to protect sites that was separate to what national parks were currently doing. And that's only a small kind of count of what the limitations were. There were many more. Another, just briefly, was the land rights movement for a generation had root in New South Wales, had also revolved around the protecting reserve lands that were being, so these were the missions, if you like, that were run by the Protection Board and then the Welfare Board. And the government, for a good decade or more, well, actually for a while, but more intensively in that decade from the 60s, were revoking those lands and pushing families into towns in the sort of pepper-potted accommodation in regional centres or in cities, so encouraging kind of migration. This was part of an assimilation, sort of modernising push.
Yep. Away from the protectionist eras to the assimilation. Yep.
Yep. And what a lot of old people are saying is they were very concerned, because they had a real forged, quite detailed attachments to the missions and reserves, and they understood that was their land and they wanted to preserve it. They didn't want government taking it away, taking it back. So that was really a focus of the land rights movement. But it was also, the movement for land rights was becoming enriched. So if we think about what was happening in the Northern Territory and those young Redfern-based activists who went to went to Canberra and put up the tent embassy, their ideas around land rights were getting richer. And in one of the conversations I had with Paul Coe, who listeners might know from the legal service days, Paul was explained that their minds were exploding with ideas and possibilities. So they were going through this decolonisation of themselves. And he explained the transition from thinking about himself as Arambi, so this is a kind of mission-based identity, to Wiradjuri. And so you can see in that, you know, this is about a kind of self-identity, enriching identity, new possibilities. And that, you know, you can see that was a connection that sort of travelled from the more traditional north back to this, our area here, where the hand of colonisation was quite a big imprint. And so when the government, when the land rights laws went through, they also put in a parallel. It was very secretive. Pat O'Shea knew nothing about it, and it was largely Frank Walker's work. They put in, passed laws validating all of the revocation of reserve lands. It was sneaky politics, it was deceptive. But what Frank argued, and he argued it in his dying days, was that it was just necessary, because he was worried also about achieving a useful outcome for Aboriginal citizens and managing the political fallout. So from his point of view, he was trying to manage what could otherwise be total backlash against the Labor government. So he was trying to manage that political fallout while at the same time delivering something that would be useful.
Mm. They did get thrown out of office, though, and, of course, Greiner came in.
Yep.
And he was hell-bent on changing the Act.
He tried everything to dismantle land rights. Yeah, they were. This is the first sort of neoliberal government in Australia, and what I think the dismantling of land rights stood as like a flag that was a window into the rest of their politics, and that is that government does not have a role. It's a sort of anti-welfare talk that is actually much more familiar today, unfortunately. That government doesn't have a role in either the social, so in supporting difference. If you want to be different...
You mean lifestyle choices?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Mm.
Yeah. So that was really where they were coming from, that they didn't support land rights because, one, it was about a transfer of public money to... to Aboriginal people, but really to anyone. You know, they were also going to cut back a whole host of welfare provisions. So they saw land rights in the frame of like a welfare kind of response.
Yeah.
And, that language hadn't developed then, but it might have, if it was today, it would be passive welfare, and the language would be about responsibility. But at that time, it was about the role of government, that government doesn't have a role in this kind of welfare, and that society should not be, no citizens should be able to think of themselves or be different. And, they tried several different ways to dismantle land rights. And what I think is really compelling, and I've argued in the book, that the campaign that the Land Council ran against Greiner, it was in the courts, it was in the streets, there were petitions, there were... full-page ads in the paper, there were rock concerts, rock for land rights. But by 1988, the public support for land rights was really starting to look very worn. But the Land Council was able to mount a campaign that is unprecedented in Australian political history to protect their interests.
Because by that stage they'd become enriched, for want of a better term. They'd... had built up quite a sizable asset base.
Yep. Yeah, and they had resources. They were able to pay for ads in the paper, employ with James Singleton, who was a well-known journalist, and then in their campaign. It was a homespun campaign initially, and then it was handed over to these professionals.
Yep.
They ran radio ads. Land Council members went door knocking throughout, in rural towns and places where, blackface is not known.
Did they play radio ads on talkback radio? Because that's usually the voice of conservative Australia, isn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So they really went into the heart of where the opposition was.
Yep.
And Greiner, in frank terms, Greiner backed down. He said, on this point, we are wrong. Yeah, so the Land Council secured a major victory in withstanding the Greiner government attacks, and And, you know, Tiger Bales was a big player in the early days of that campaign as well.
Mm. Yeah, I think his ears are burning because we're talking about him. I am conscious that you have to go to another interview, and I do want to just finish with this particular question, and I guess it's a question that is going to be asked of you by journalists everywhere. With all of the optimism that the 1970s, you know, promised, I suppose, in terms of the land rights movement to address and ameliorate the conditions of First Nations people at that time, we're still struggling with those issues today. Is it something wrong with the mechanism? Is it something wrong with the people behind the scenes? What is it? Why haven't we made any real change in regards to that? Why do things seem to be getting worse rather than better?
I guess that's, I mean, that is the question, isn't it?
Because yep.
Not much point in recounting this incredible movement and incredible people and, you know, incredible political strategists unless something really quite significant happens out of it. And I think, I guess what I would just say briefly is that, you know, in the opening years of the Land Rights Act, there were some almost 2,000 land claims lodged. There were 115 local Aboriginal land councils established. So you can imagine in country towns, that was getting a office space, desk, tables, getting electricity hooked up, telephones. There were 12 regional councils, so similar offices set up, representatives elected, and, you know, what might have been a like a, you know, family gathering under the carport sitting around sort of became a land council meeting. So this was a rapid, incredible activity on the part of Aboriginal people in New South Wales to make these laws work. And at the same time, quite a lot of money flowed. Whether it was adequate compensation is a different story. But quite a lot of money came into the land council network. And many of the enterprises that were set up, they failed to thrive. And there are some important lessons from that. But I think if you were to say, in many communities, we didn't have capacity, didn't have much capacity in our community at that time. This was an unknown, untested. The laws themselves were very thin. And part of what Walker was saying was that he rushed these laws through because he was quite concerned about the political backlash. And it's been a trial and error process, really, developing land rights in New South Wales. So land rights didn't so much arrive as the door was opened and the process of land rights began. And I think, you know, that if you think about how you deal with both tradition and, you know, modernity, that it was a bruising experience. Many people, I think, felt very disappointed and felt a deep hurt in with their experience of land rights. You know, they found themselves hauled up before the Independent Commission Against Corruption for doing things they had no idea they'd done wrong, you know, in some cases, in many cases. You know, other people may well have been a little bit more willingly kind of doing the wrong thing. And others, you know, found themselves in the middle of these heated political battles with businesses that went belly up, you know, were being sold, businesses that were absolute lemons. So, you know, this is quite a bruising but incredibly steep learning curve.
Yep.
And I think we're yet to see the full benefits of land rights, but its time will come.
Well, we are dealing with more than 200 years of colonisation and really, when you look at the Land Rights Act, it's really only 32 years old, so I guess we can't expect it to deliver everything at once.
Yeah, we can't expect miracles. And, you know, I think we have to kind of be a bit gentle in how we kind of look through these moments.
And success might be different. I mean, the question that I posed to you was probably from the perspective of a white journalist rather than of a, you know, a Koori or a Murray journalist or just a regular person on the street. I mean, success from a blackfellas perspective might be quite different.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, look, we do appreciate your time this morning, Dr. Heidi Norman, and wish you well in your next endeavour, whatever that might be. But the book is available now?
Yes, yep. You can order it through Aboriginal Studies Press. And it's also available in good bookshops.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks, Karen.
Dr. Heidi Norman, who is a senior lecturer in the Communications Program at the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences at the University of Technology, has been our guest today here on Let's Talk, talking about her book, What Do We Want? A Political History of Aboriginal Land Rights in New South Wales.